Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Andrew.
I'm Rachel.
And we are Picture the Scene Podcast. We are a true crime podcast aiming to put you, the listener, at the scene of the crime. Now, I think, actually, we just very cutely got interrupted there. So I thought it's probably a good way just to give a warning to everyone that I am in a little bit of an echoey room today, so I apologise for that. And also, Rachel has the most adorable Marnie with her this morning. For those that didn't see our social media post, Marnie is Rachel's new addition to her family. Is that not right, Rachel?
That is absolutely correct. And she is 11 weeks old tomorrow, so still very new. And I apologise if she interrupts our recordings today.
That's okay. It's okay. It's allowed. And introducing her to true crime at an early age, that's what we like, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. She absolutely loves the true crime documentaries that have been keeping me going over the last 11 weeks. So, absolutely.
Right. So, each week, we delve into the murky world of lesser-known crimes from the UK and Ireland. And occasionally, we venture into renowned cases from around the globe. We are available on all the major social media channels. Just search for us by our name, surprisingly, and I'm sure you'll find us. And also simply because it makes us happier than Taylor Swift at a Super Bowl, please do leave us a rating and review if you have the capability.
I've seen Taylor Swift at the Super Bowl and she was pretty happy.
Exactly. Now, if you like us that much that you want to support us and see us carry on doing this for the foreseeable, then please do head over to Patreon, where you can support us for as little as £1 a month. We have bonus content and episodes, depending on your tier, and it really does help us carry on. Now, because we recorded so many episodes in advance, I'd like to give a massive shout-out to Alison Clark, Margaret Napier, and Claire Bragg, who have become Patreon subscribers recently, and also to our long-standing Patreon member, Debbie Richards, who recently increased her pledge. So thank you. Exactly. Thank you all, and thanks to the rest of our Patreon supporters, who also support us week in and week out.
Yeah, welcome to the family, guys. Very grateful to have you here.
Yes, indeed. It always makes me so happy when I see that. Not because of the money, but because someone likes it enough to do that.
You know, and Andrew's been sharing some absolutely amazing feedback and comments and just things like that with me whilst I've been on that 3-month sabbatical from Picture the Scene. And I'm honestly amazed every time someone takes the time to reach out and give us feedback. And sometimes it's constructive, but most of the time it's just so lovely and heartwarming. Even the constructive stuff is good because it helps us obviously improve for our listeners. But just the lovely comments about our scripts, about cases, about our, you know, rapport with each other. It's really, it blows my mind that people take the time out to leave such wonderful feedback. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts for that.
Yes, it sometimes adds a bit of joy into what can be quite a bleak world.
Well, that sounds quite a bleak world of true crime. Yes. A bleak world of true crime, not a bleak world for our general lives, Andrew.
Yeah, that's true. So we do where possible now release episodes a week early for our Patreon supporters. So if you want to hear next week's episode today, then head over to Patreon. So Rachel and Rach, it's been so long since we've done this that I've missed it. And you know, I told you this yesterday, I've missed you as well. So how have you been?
Tired mostly. Yeah, no, but honestly, it's the most amazing feeling in the world having her here, and she has completed our family, and our daughter's adapted really well to the new addition, and we're coping really well, so I can't complain. I can't believe how quickly the last 3 months have gone. Feels like yesterday that we were sat recording and saying, oh gosh, we've got quite a break coming up, and but likewise, it feels like forever ago that we had Christmas. So my concept of time is really skewed at the minute. How have you been?
I've been great, plodding along, getting on with life. It's currently snowing quite badly today, so I am a bit sanctified today, but yeah, all good.
By the way, just great.
Oh, I am sparkling. It's been a while.
Come on, keep on.
More importantly, though, Rachel, more important than how I am, are you ready for some true crime?
Oh, yeah, I can't wait. I've got a smile from ear to ear on my face for this recording.
Great.
Let's go.
Let's go. So if it's safe for you to do so, I'd like you to relax. Close your eyes and picture the scene. Today, I'd like to take us back to the 9th of November, 2021. And on this date, we're heading off to Worksop in Nottinghamshire. Now, Worksop is a small market town of around 45,000 people. It's located roughly in between the cities of Nottingham and Sheffield. And while it did struggle with all the coal mine closures in the 1990s, it's been able to recover somewhat and is now a bustling little town, a little nice little market town. So on this day in particular, we're heading off to a small group of properties in the estate of Rayton Spur in Worksop. Now, this is a group of 56 one-bedroom bungalows that are managed by the local council, and they are age-exclusive housing. Now, this means, for those of you that don't know, this means that you have to be over a certain age, in this instance 60, to be exact, to be able to get one of these properties from the council. Now, on this day, it wakes up on the 9th of November, 2021. It was a reasonably warm day for the time of the year, with highs of around 14 degrees Celsius, which is around 57 degrees Fahrenheit, and there was a northeasterly wind blowing of around 11 miles per hour, and it was dry. Now, for November's day, that's not too bad a bit of weather there.
No, especially at the minute, like it's March and it's snowing where you are.
Exactly. Now, it was a Tuesday, and we're heading off to the afternoon, and one resident, Pauline Quinn, was at home that afternoon, like she was most days. You see, Rachel, Pauline lived alone, and she was at home most days because she was 73 years old. She was infirm, she walked with a stick, and was registered as disabled due to having a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So getting out and about, it wasn't really an easy task for her, so she didn't do it often.
And this estate that she lived in, was there assistance, like, was it assisted living kind of like?
No.
Oh, wow. So she would have relied on community nurses to be coming around to like wash her and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I say no. And yes, she was still as independent as she could be. I mean, she still owned a car, but she didn't get out about much. It wasn't assisted living. They had one of those cords.
Warden. Yeah.
Well, so if they pulled a cord, wardens would come, but yeah, it wasn't assisted living, as in people didn't assist her in the day to day life.
Yeah, and actually that's what I meant, like the wardens that would like be on hand in an emergency. So yeah, no, that's, I think that kind of builds a picture, doesn't it, of like, yeah, some of these residential areas are quite independent living, aren't they, where people are still like gardening and, you know, and looking after their property inside and out. And then other types of residences are literally, you know, you get out once a week to go to the community hall for bingo, which is on the same property, because you don't really get out much.
Yeah, no, I always have the fear when I go and visit my mum that when I'm in her toilet, like instead of turning the light on or off, I pull the emergency cord. So I haven't done it yet, but one day it'll happen.
I have that exact same fear for my daughter. Like if we have to go in like an accessible toilet or something like that, I'm like, do not touch the red cord, Georgia, like under no circumstances. And she's like, what would happen? I'm like, I'm not even telling you what would happen. It would be bad.
So Pauline's husband, Rachel, had passed away some years before, but Pauline had three children, Lisa, Janice and Thomas, along with, she also had a sister, Catherine, and she was also a grandmother. So she still had quite a big family presence in her life.
Yeah.
She was described as being a caring person. And even though she didn't have much money, she was always generous when she could be. And she was known for a sense of humour, always managing to make most people laugh, regardless of their age or life experience. Now, she was known for being the type of person that would do anything for anyone. So it was 4 p.m. when Pauline heard a knocking on her back door. Now, this was unusual, Rachel, because people didn't knock on her back door usually, as it was closed off with a fence all around her back garden. So she got up to answer the door to see who it was. When she answered the door, She could see that it was her next door neighbour, Lawrence Beaton, who was 61 years old. Now, Lawrence had climbed over the fence that separated their two back gardens. And when she asked him what he wanted, he told her that he had run out of money and he wanted to buy more alcohol.
Oh, wow.
Now, you see, Lawrence had spent the morning and early afternoon drinking vodka and rum before running out. Now, he had also taken that day some crack cocaine and Subutex, usually used to treat opioid addiction, along with acute pain and chronic pain. So he'd been on a bender, basically, for all day.
I mean, did she know that he was an addict living next door to her? Did she have any inkling until this point?
I don't believe so, no.
Wow. That would be quite a revelation, wouldn't it? Like, for a 75-year-old woman to see, A, her next-door neighbour, a 61-year-old man, climbing over a back fence and demanding money. But in a residential like community like this, you'd presume you were quite safe with your neighbours, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would. Yeah, it was quite a quiet neighbourhood. It wasn't like a rough place or anything like that.
No, yeah. Okay.
Now, we're not sure why. I'm guessing due to the state he was in, and there are random requests anyway, but Pauly said no to Lawrence. She would not give him any money.
Why would she though? If your next door neighbour came banging on your door and he'd scaled your fence, I think my initial reaction would be go away.
Yeah, and he said he wanted it for alcohol as well.
Yeah.
So when she said no, though, he got angry, Rachel, and he pushed her to the ground. When she got up and fled him in fear, she went back inside of her bungalow to get away from him, and he followed her. Now, in a desperate attempt for help, Pauly managed to get to her living room and pull that alarm cord that we just spoke about earlier that these bungalows had in various rooms so that residents could get help if needed, and she most definitely needed help right now. Now, when these calls are pulled, I didn't know this, but not only should it summon a suitable person, a warden usually, to attend the property to give the elderly or vulnerable resident help, did you know that they automatically start recording audio too?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, so they do. So what happened next was fully captured in an audio recording. That's why we know what happened.
Is that, sorry to ask all the questions, but is that across all red cord cords in the UK, like even in toilets?
No, not toilet. It's residential ones.
Oh, okay. Wow. Gosh, that's clever, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm guessing if you have an opportunity to say, I've fallen, and like if you know it's recording, you could be like, I've fallen, just in case I lose consciousness, this is how many stairs I fell down, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so definitely. So Lawrence proceeded to pick up a wooden coffee table that Pauline had in her living room after he had pushed it to the floor. And he proceeded to bludgeon Pauly to death with it.
Oh my God, a coffee table.
Yes.
So, jeez, what a brutal attack.
Yeah, and it was all caught on audio. So defensive wounds on her arms indicate that at first Pauly did try her best to protect her head. She fought for her life, actually. But in all reality, she stood no chance against a stronger, manic, and let's be brutally honest, evil person that was in front of her, and he was determined to kill her.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds pretty accurate to me. What? Can I just ask one more question before we move on?
Of course.
In terms of the recording, wherever that pings to, say the warden's office, does that then become, can they just hear that from the minute the cord's pulled, or do they have to go back and listen to the recording? Is it live?
I don't think it's live. I'm not entirely certain, to be honest. I don't think it's live, but I'm not entirely certain.
Just on the basis, let's pretend it was live. How horrifying would that be?
Yeah.
That, you know, ding, ding, ding. Oh, there's an issue with flat 73. Let's go. And then you hear this screaming and this, no, please stop. And that would just be really harrowing, wouldn't it?
It would be, yeah. And it would be, yeah. I'll get onto that cord later, actually. So all in all, Pauline suffered 29 different injuries, made with 14 blows, 10 of those to her head. Her injuries included a fracture of her skull and brain damage. So police would later describe in court that blood was splattered over quite a large area, which indicates that the blows that rained down on Pauline would have been made with extreme force. Now, this was also backed up at one point by the sound of a light fitting breaking as on the audio recording as he lifted a table above his head on repeated times to get more force to inflict upon Pauline. And with the sounds on the recording, the sound of wood breaking when it hit Pauline's head. Now, the evidence would show that there could be no doubt really as to what his intention was. And that intention was to kill. The recording also captured that this was not a quick, frenzied attack like you might imagine it was. The time between the strikes would indicate that he was taking his time to ensure that he could target Pauline on her body and hit her with as much force and accuracy as possible.
Wow.
Yeah, he was in complete control. And this is actually important to note when we come to his defense in court a little later on. But there's no way this was like an out-of-control, frenzied attack. He was in complete control. And every single strike that he made on Pauline was intentional and accurate.
After makes Pauline, it far worse, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It does because it shows you what type of person he is. Now,
yeah, and do you know what? Sorry, do you know what? If he had have had the money that morning, he may still well have killed her. Like, I'm just thinking out loud here, but say, for instance, she gave him 50 quid. He may well have thought, an opportunistic moment. She's got 50 quid on her. How much more has she got?
Yeah.
You know, I wonder whether there was a right or wrong answer to give him at that moment, whether he'd have still seen red.
I don't mean to jump ahead, but he never actually ended up stealing any money.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
I just realised I didn't put that in the story, but yeah, he never actually stole any money, so...
So it was all completely for nothing?
Well, at this point, it was all completely about the murder, but yes. So after Pauline was dead,
Pauline died?
I just lied to you anyway, because I said he didn't steal anything, and he did steal something. After Pauline died, he would take her car keys, so he stole her car, and CCTV would catch him calmly driving away in her car. He would return a little later with a plastic bag and put the broken pieces of the coffee table he'd used to kill Pauline in the bag before leaving her home again.
But the warden would have been to the property between that time, wouldn't they?
No, well, this is the thing. No one actually attended.
Wow. That's mad.
Yeah.
So these residential properties have wardens available and services, facilities available, but aren't manned 24 hours a day.
Well, it never actually went into why no one attended. It could have been that someone was supposed to be on duty, but it wasn't. I really don't know, because it never actually, that never went into detail, but.
Wow.
But yeah, no, because there was an internal inquiry, which some bits came out, but it was kept private for the family's sake. So yeah, we don't actually know why no one attended immediately. So that's why he could go back and just collect a piece of the coffee table and leave again in her car.
And I take it none the wiser that everything had been recorded on the cord.
Oh yeah, no, he had no idea that happened. Yeah.
Wow.
So he then drove Pauline's Renault Clio to one of his relatives, and he stayed there overnight before giving his relative a lift in Pauline's car to work the following morning in nearby Barnsley. Now, by now, she had been discovered. So he was arrested the following morning at 10:37 a.m. in a Texaco petrol station while filling the car up. Now, when he was arrested, the police body cam caught him saying to his relative, "You're not going to like this. I've effing killed someone."
Oh, wow.
Now, before we get into what happened after his arrest, should we have a little look at who Lawrence Beaton is? Try to figure out why he did what he did. So yeah, any ideas before we get into this?
Any ideas who he is?
Yeah, like what his background is. What maybe made him want to do this?
Well, he's clearly got a habit. I'm guessing he might have been an ex-convict. You know, it seems like it escalated pretty quick for him, so probably not the first time he's gotten mad. But yeah, I think that's about as far as I'm going to go with guessing.
Okay. Well, he was born in 1960. And as for his early life and early adulthood, I'm afraid there's little information out there on him as a person. And most of what is out there, I've actually got my doubts on how true it is. It felt like it was people making up online, so I'm not going to include it. But with regards to his criminal background, while I was unable to get what the offences actually were, we do know that he began committing crime with his first court appearance being as a child. So he began really early. And he continued to be a repeat offender up until 1995.
Wow.
Now, remember, this is 2021 that he killed himself. Up until 1995. Now, you may say, what happened in 1995 to make him stop being offending? So he was in his mid-30s by now. And in 1995, he lived in Worksop still. And he was friends with a man called Michael Pluck. And Lawrence and Michael would often do odd jobs and gardening for a pair of old women who were sisters and lived together. Now, the old women were called Elsie Gregory and Aileen Dudhill, and they were 72 and 79, respectively. Now, Lawrence and Michael went to the two ladies' house back in 1995, and they managed to convince them that they needed a garden cut in, for which they charged the two women £120. Now, while they were at the house, pretending to cut the garden, because they never actually cut the garden, Lawrence was scoping it out to see what could be stolen. 3 days later, they returned to Elsie and Eileen's house on the pretense that they had left some tools there, so they needed to collect them. Elsie took Michael into the garden to look for a missing spanner, and as she did, Lawrence stayed in the house looking for money, jewellery, and other small valuable items that he could steal. Now, Elsie became suspicious, though, and went back inside to find Lawrence going through the kitchen drawers looking for things to steal.
Oh my God. That would be your worst nightmare as an older person, letting somebody you thought you could trust in your house and then catching them snooping.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when he realised he had been caught, Lawrence punched Elsie in the face, knocking her to the ground, before attacking her with a hammer. Now, coincidentally, she suffered almost identical injuries that Pauline had inflicted upon her that I outlined before. So maybe, just maybe, when he was being deliberate and precise in his attack on Pauline, this might have been a reason to relive what he did with Elsie. I'm taking a guess there, but...
Just for that rush.
Yeah, to say that she suffered almost identical injuries, that's a big coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Now, Elsie's sister, Eileen, remember they lived together,
yeah,
heard all the noise and screamed at Lawrence to leave her sister alone. Upon hearing her screaming, he grabbed a kitchen knife and he stabbed her to death before turning around to his friend, Michael, to say, "I've killed the old bitch."
Oh, my God.
Exactly. Now, when he realised that Elsie was in fact still alive... He grabbed a cushion and he placed it over her face and smothered her to death.
Wow.
The pair then stole more things from the two sisters' home before setting it on fire to cover their tracks. So when he was arrested for those two murders, the police actually discovered Elsie's false teeth in what was left of a bonfire in Lawrence's garden. So he never actually explained why he took her false teeth with him. Both, it could have been as a trophy, who knows. But both Lawrence and Michael would be arrested. And despite pleading not guilty and giving a false alibi, they were both found guilty of the double murder. Both would be sentenced to life in prison. And I was unable to get the minimum terms. But Michael Pluck would appeal a few times against his conviction, but he was never successful. And he would die in prison in 2012.
Oh, wow.
Now, Lawrence, after serving 21 years in prison, would be released on a lifelong license in 2017. He had very strict conditions, which included not drinking or taking drugs. But less than a year after his release, he was recalled to prison for taking both drink and drugs. So now let's fast forward to May of 2020. And he was again released by the parole board, initially moving into a bail hostel until he was placed in a bungalow next to Pauline in November of 2020. So after his arrest, he would be interviewed several times. The first three times, he would no comment or deny guilt. It wasn't until the fourth interview after he was arrested that he admitted killing Pauline with the excuse that he was an alcoholic and he was unable to control himself, so he was not responsible for his actions.
That's so bad.
Yeah, so when it went to court, so by now he's a triple murderer.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, quite controversially, he got assisted housing. He basically got a new chance at life.
Yeah.
And Pauline and no one else in that estate would have had a Scooby that he was a convicted murderer, right?
No, no one knew.
It's not fair, is it?
It's not. And wait till we hear what else happens here.
And sorry, just one more thing. A convicted murderer of elderly, vulnerable women.
In their home, yeah.
So how on earth isn't there the same kind of protection that there would be for, you know, other vulnerable people in life when somebody's got form like that? Oh, yeah, sure, throw him in a residential property on the council next door to a woman that's, you know, oh, mad.
I know.
Really upsetting.
8 months before before he killed Pauline, he had a... When he'd been released, he had an ankle tag, which it didn't track his movement, but it tracked his alcohol consumption, if he took alcohol or not. And he actually had them take it off 8 months before because he said it was causing his leg to swell. And crazily enough, I was looking into it, and those tags are actually voluntary. So at any point they can choose to put one on, but at any point the person can go, no, I don't want that on anymore, and just get it taken off.
But of course.
What's the point? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. If you think you might fancy a drink and sod the rules that you've been released on, oh, it's making my ankle swell. Okay, so we'll take it off for you because it's voluntary. You're just going to play the system there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Mad.
So when it went to court, he pled not guilty on the grounds of diminished responsibility. He said that he was out of control due to having withdrawal symptoms from alcohol dependency. Now, the jury wouldn't take long, you'd be happy to hear, to find him guilty of murder, rejecting his diminished responsibility defense completely.
Good.
So when sentencing, the judge made sure in his remarks to tell him that he considered the fact that the attack on Pauline was not frenzied, that they could tell from the audio recording, because what happened most of the trial was just the audio recording played over and over for either for the defense or the prosecution.
Yeah.
So the judge said that he could tell from the audio recording that was played that it just wasn't a frenzied attack at all. Then also, when CCTV caught him, like after he had left, either driving or walking around, that he was in full control of his driving and also walking around. And he had the calmness to go back for the murder weapon so he wouldn't have left it to be found.
Yeah, and like when he got arrested, he went, you're not going to like this, I've killed someone. Like that in itself is quite calm and calculated, isn't it? Like there's no period where he blacked out and he's like, what are you arresting me for? I don't have a clue what I've done. It's like, you know, he's finally been caught and he's like, oh, by the way, I've had somebody off, so they're about to take me to jail.
Yeah. The judge also said that he was in no doubt whatsoever that he had killed Pauline on purpose, and that while he acknowledged that it probably wasn't a pre-planned murder, his intention was still to kill, not to steal. The fact that he stole the car afterwards was just something he did once he had killed her, and he hadn't intended to steal anything from her in the first place.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of said, if she'd have said yes to the money, would she have still had her life taken from her so cruelly? Because I think the way it escalated, he went there with an intention, and the money was going to be a bonus, I feel.
Yeah, and yeah, I personally feel as well, yeah, he was wanting just to get that kill again that he did from years before.
Yeah, the way that you said he he was calculated in the sense that he did exactly the same to Pauline. Yeah. What a nasty piece of work.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, the judge said there were several aggravating features of this murder. Firstly, the fact that Pauline was elderly and disabled. Secondly, that she was murdered in her own home, which was supposed to be a place of safety. Thirdly, the brutal and sustained nature of the attack. Then the fact that he used a weapon, and also the fact that Pauline would have suffered both psychological and physical suffering as she was being attacked. Now, the judge did point out, though, that all these paled into insignificance compared to the biggest aggravating factor was the fact that he had already killed twice before, with one of these deaths being almost identical to Pauline's, and the fact that he killed Pauline just 18 months after his second release. The judge commented on the fact that he was placed in a bungalow next to an elderly and vulnerable woman when he'd killed twice before, that exact type of person, as you pointed out. The judge also pointed out that the police did raise concerns about this at the time he was placed in a bungalow, but the probation service ignored those concerns and placed him there anyway.
Gosh, you'd have imagined it would have been the other way around. The probation service warning the police or the local council.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So actually the probation service, after the fact, which is always after the fact and always too late, they accepted it was wrong of what they did and they should never have placed in the first place.
It's too late. Yeah. Like, you know, lessons will be learned from this. How often do we hear that?
Yeah. I know. All stupid. And it's such an obvious, it's not like sometimes they can be a bit abstract and you think, yeah, like you can see how that was missed. Yeah, but this is just so obvious. He was placed next to his type of victim, yeah. So finally, the judge said that he couldn't see any remorse in Lawrence for the murder, that he showed remorse for how it may impact his family, but not for the actual killing. Now, the only two points of mitigation was the fact that he did admit that he killed Pauline and the fact that there was no significant planning for the crime. So after the trial, along with the victim impact statement from Pauline's family, also rightly so, pointing out how this man was allowed to live next door to their mum, Marguerite Fretwell, who was 82 now, but she was a niece of the two women that he'd killed back in 1995, she would say this: "I could not understand why he had been released in the first place. I also absolutely cannot understand how someone who killed two elderly ladies had then been put near to elderly people who wouldn't be able to fight back. I honestly don't think people like him are the kind of people who change, even after going to prison. The details of what he did to my aunties and the similarities to what he did to Pauline are horrendous." Which I think she sums that up perfectly, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So
it must have been quite emotional for her to stand up in court and say that, like, what, 20 years on? No. 30 years on from the murders. Like, you know, that to me, that's completely unnecessary for her to have to relive and have to do that. In terms of your other question, what do I think?
I was about to ask, I don't mean to cut you off, I was about to ask what you think the sentence he was given for this murder, given it was his third one in his life.
What? Sorry, Andrew, what was the sentence again? Missed that.
I haven't told you. That's why I'm asking you.
Oh, okay. Gosh, I thought I'd missed something there.
No.
I'd hope it was life in prison without the opportunity for parole.
Well, Rachel, you would be right. He was given a whole life order never to be released again.
Good. Because you can't trust a man, especially because his defense was that he was suffering from withdrawal symptoms of his drug and alcohol addiction. How do you manage that in future in the community?
Not when he wasn't supposed to be drinking or taking drugs anyway, and he should have been back in prison for it. Yeah,
100%. So, you know, I think in these cases, the parole system is quite trustworthy. If you can't evidence on your third offense, murder or otherwise, you can't evidence that you can stand by it, then you have to be incarcerated. And you know, our view on it is very similar in terms of prison is not a rehabilitation opportunity in the UK, and it's not used the way it should be. We also do not believe that life in prison should be problem solved, just chuck away the key. It's not the way to get beyond problems, but this particular individual is dangerous and to the some of the most vulnerable in our society. So absolutely right decision.
So shall I wrap this one up then, Rachel?
Go for it.
So this has been season 4, episode 15, called Repeat Offender. And if it's safe for you to do so, I'd like you to relax, close your eyes and picture the scene. If I was to say to you, while you have your eyes closed, describe your gran or an old woman that you know, most of you will surely say kind, generous, maybe funny, loving, frail, vulnerable, and trusting. Now remember, all these words were used to describe Pauline. So let me ask you a question. Why would anyone want to hurt someone like that? So with that question that I'll leave you with, thank you all, and we shall see you next time.
See you soon, guys. Thank you.